Hey there, Here and Now Anytime listener. If you like this show, we'd love it if you followed us or subscribed wherever you get your podcasts. Just look for Here and Now Anytime. Also, I know you hear this a lot, but if you can leave a rating or a review while you're at it, we would really appreciate it. It just takes a second and it helps us a lot. Of course, you can also tell your friends to subscribe. That helps too. And thanks. Now here's the show.
After a 30-year winter of sectarian violence, Northern Ireland today has the promise of a springtime of peace.
President Bill Clinton, 25 years ago today, when the Good Friday Agreement forged a fragile peace in Northern Ireland. It's Monday, April 10th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, it's been 25 years since the Good Friday Agreement. We'll hear from one of the deal's negotiators and a priest about building bridges between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. And we'll hear from the longtime host of the festival known as the Olympics of Hula, which is happening this week in Hawaii. But first, most of the abortions in this country are induced via medication. And now, the legality of the most widely used abortion drug is up in the air after two conflicting court rulings late last week. Mary Ziegler has been following the cases. She's a legal historian and law professor at the University of California, Davis. And she spoke to Scott Tong about what those two rulings mean for women who want to end a pregnancy. Here's Scott.
Lots to untangle legally. First, can you help us understand the Texas ruling from Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, Trump appointee? What is his reasoning to invalidate the FDA approval of mifepristone?
Sure, there were kind of two bases. First, he said that under the Federal Comstock Act, which is an anti-vice law from the 19th century, that it would be a federal crime to mail mifepristone. Now, that federal law has fallen into disuse, using it maybe unconstitutional. Not everyone agrees with this interpretation, but that was one basis. The second basis was that the FDA lacked the authority to approve mifepristone in 2000 because it had relied, in his view, on faulty science. So that there were kind of two independent grounds.
In a separate case in Washington State, the judge Thomas Rice, an Obama appointee, ordered the FDA to keep this drug on the market. So with these conflicting rulings, what does it mean for access right now to mifepristone?
Well, we're still kind of waiting to see what the FDA actually says and it's going to do. In the short term, the FDA is most likely to say, essentially, we can't comply with both of these rulings. And the closest we can come is to leave the status quo in place, essentially to say, when mifepristone becomes unapproved, if Kaczmarek's ruling doesn't change in the 7-day window he provided for appeal, we're going to use our discretion to leave the status quo in place until we get a definitive ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, which I think we're going to have to get because this has produced a lot of chaos.
What do we know about the plaintiffs in Texas, how they pulled off this legal strategy to get this ruling?
Yeah, some of this has to do with judge shopping. The district courts in Texas are set up in such a way that if you file a suit, for example, in Dallas, there are any number of district judges you could appear before. There is only one judge in the district for Amarillo. That's Matthew Kaczmarek, who's widely viewed as, I think, the most sympathetic to the anti-abortion movement, or at least predicted to be. And so there was a choice made by the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine and the Alliance Defending Freedom, just the lawyers behind this, to seek out Judge Kaczmarek, believing that he would be a sympathetic ear.
Yeah. And finally, let me ask you about the FDA. It is no stranger to politics, say with vaccines or other political debates here. But what are the implications for the FDA to potentially undermine its expertise, its authority to decide which drugs are safe for all of us?
Well, I think there's really a danger here that if Judge Kaczmarek's ruling stands, that it'll open a door to challenges of other drugs that people don't like or find divisive, whether that's gender-affirming therapies, COVID vaccines, because there simply wasn't new evidence here. A lot of the studies and claims that the ADF relied on here had been around for some time. Judge Kaczmarek just bought the arguments, right? Essentially, they relitigated the science before Judge Kaczmarek, and he took their side. And that sets a precedent that others who don't like conclusions reached by the experts at FDA can replicate that feat. So there's a real possibility that the FDA's authority will be undermined going forward.
Mary Ziegler is a legal historian and law professor at the University of California, Davis. Mary, thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, 25 years ago, the Good Friday Agreement helped end sectarian violence in Northern Ireland. After the break, we'll hear from two people who waded into the heart of the Troubles and helped broker peace. Stick around. This week, President Biden heads to Ireland and Northern Ireland to mark the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. That's the peace deal that formally ended decades of violence between Protestant Unionists, who want Northern Ireland to remain part of the United Kingdom, and Catholic Nationalists, who want reunification with the Republic of Ireland. Thousands of people died in the violence that preceded that agreement, known as the Troubles. Here's then-President Bill Clinton on April 10th, 1998.
The agreement that has emerged from the Northern Ireland peace talks opens the way for the people there to build a society based on enduring peace, justice, and equality.
In a minute, we'll hear from a Catholic priest in Northern Ireland. But first, a few minutes with George Mitchell, who was Clinton's envoy to Northern Ireland and was the chairman of the peace talks that led to the Good Friday Agreement. Peter O'Dowd spoke with Mitchell 5 years ago on the 20th anniversary of the historic agreement. Here's a bit from that conversation.
It is an ancient conflict stretching back centuries with periodic outbreaks of violence. The most recent lasted about 20 years, and over that time, about 3,600 people were killed. But that understates the violence because they had a horrific practice of engaging in what were called punishment beatings, where people were permanently maimed and crippled, and those numbers were in the tens of thousands. It was very difficult when I first went there. Roadblocks, military, armored cars, really a state of siege.
So what were you thinking when these negotiations started? Did you really think that you could break the impasse?
I was naive, to say the least, when I first went there. Didn't have much exposure to the issue before. Had never been to Northern Ireland before. But by the time the talks began, I had been there for a year and a half, and so I had gained a sense of how difficult it would be and how violent it would be, and the talks themselves were extremely difficult.
The Irish novelist Colm McCann wrote that your success was that you never took sides, and I want to read you what he wrote a couple of years ago. He said, "You split a feather down the middle and encouraged both sides to take flight."
Well, I tried very hard to be fair and nonpartisan. I'd had experience 6 years as majority leader of the U.S. Senate. Gives you some practice in trying to bring people together. Before that, I'd been a federal judge and a United States attorney. And so while there was considerable opposition to my serving as chairman at the outset, by the time we finished, we're all very friendly, and we've remained personal friends, really, for the rest of the lives of many of the people who have passed away, and some still continue. So it was, for me, a dramatic experience, but a very difficult one. 5 years is a long time. In the end, it worked out, and I'm an American, very proud of it, but a large part of my heart and of my emotions will always be there in Northern Ireland.
The peace that Mitchell helped broker in 1998 was fragile. 4 months after the Good Friday Agreement was signed, the deadliest bombing of the Troubles killed 29 people in the town of Omagh. And ever since then, the Reverend Kevin Mullen has continued his work building bridges between Catholics and Protestants in Omagh. Today, he reflected on the anniversary in a conversation with Deepa Fernandez.
I'm feeling so proud of the giants who signed that agreement, and I just think we owe them so much to live out what they risked everything for.
You know, 25 years, I'm guessing, of relative calm. There were, as we mentioned, one big attack after that. There was even one recently, a few weeks ago. I'm wondering, has the last 25 years felt like calm for people where you are in Omagh, Father?
Generally, yes. I think it has been a time when we were not afraid that every time we went out the door something would happen. But Omaha has been unfortunate in the sense that not only was it the site of the great Oma bomb in August of 98, but a policeman was shot, and then a policeman was wounded in the last few months here as well. It just seemed to be that people were, again, picking an Oma, and we felt we were being forced to go through so much again. But we are very resilient. We will come through.
You said both Mass, the midnight Mass on Easter Saturday, you preached again on Easter Sunday. Father, what did you tell the congregation on this really momentous occasion of the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement?
I felt that I had to draw a parallel, though the comparisons are not equal, between the trust that people put in one another 25 years ago and the trust that God extended towards us in sending us his own son. And even though that son was brutally killed, God's trust in us continued, and we owe it to God to do our best to live as he wants to. I just felt it was a time for just mentioning the whole idea of trust.
Was there any, you know, sense of having to maybe calm people? Are people on edge? Because we've been reading in the last week or so that British intelligence, MI5, said that some kind of violence today particularly is highly possible. Are people on edge there, Father?
I think, no, we're not on edge. We do hope it will be quiet and that the security forces will contain any outbreak of difficulty in that city,
okay,
where I worked myself for a long time.
I'm glad to hear that, Father. You know, we read in the New York Times that one Protestant woman there from Omaha, she detests, she said, the Good Friday Accord because she calls it an appeasement to Catholics, who she calls terrorists. It just made us wonder if there's still the simmering tension between Protestants and Catholics, maybe not just in Omaha, but across Northern Ireland. And we know you've worked a lot on bringing the two communities together. Is there still the tension, Father?
I think she has spoken a little truth there, all right. There are centuries and centuries of suspicion and distrust between the communities. I know there are some Protestants who still believe that Roman Catholic worship is superstition and magic. That is hurtful. And I know there are some Catholics who believe that Protestant worship is just merely words and there's nothing to it. That is hurtful as well. We have to get to know each other and see the good that's there in every heart and build on that.
You've spent 25 years doing that work, Father, that hard work of having people talk to and listen to each other. I wonder if you can leave us with one story of how that's worked and how you have maybe brought people together.
I just want to mention, yesterday morning at 7 o'clock, as the sun was rising, a lot of churches have a dawn service for Easter, and this year, here in this little village, two church communities came together, a very, very large number of people, larger than we had any other time. We went to an old, centuries-old burial chamber overlooking the lake, and we said, we want to be together with our history and together in our future. That was built up on years and years of having tea in one of those houses and just sharing sympathy when somebody died or being part of community. But it's built up on tiny, tiny, tiny steps. And I must say, it goes back for me more than 25 years. It goes back 50 years of my whole priesthood. I was just very lucky to live next door to people of different faiths. We just got on as good neighbours, a lovely relationship that we could draw on when it was needed.
It sounds beautiful, Father. Father Kevin Mullen, Roman Catholic priest, who builds bridges between his own Catholic people and Protestants in Northern Ireland. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Deepa, and we will give President Joe a warm welcome tomorrow night and in the coming days.
By the way, you can hear our whole conversation with negotiator George Mitchell, whom we heard from a minute ago, at hereandnow.org. coming up next.
Oko aloha no. Ai ai kalani.
The Olympics of Hula are on, and Deepa will take you there after the break.
This year is the 60th anniversary of what's become the biggest festival of hula and Hawaiian culture in the world, the Merry Monarch Festival, which takes place in Hilo this week. Fans will see and hear a wide range of hula, like this. And also like this. Thousands of people from all over the world attend the Merry Monarch Festival, and those who can't be there watch the live stream on the web. And for more than four decades, the event has been hosted by Hawaiian personality Kimo Kahoano, an actor and singer, and early in his career, one of Hawaii's top Polynesian fire knife dancers. He's a legend in Hawaii, and Kimo joins me now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Deepa. Aloha. Aloha mai kakou, everyone.
Aloha. I wonder if you can start, Kimo, by telling us what the Merry Monarch Festival means to you.
It's everything. It's just wonderful. It's respect. It's art. It's aloha. It's the discipline. It's learning the hula and learning it well, and actually an opportunity to grow yourself that way in life.
Tell us how the hula is connected to Hawaiian culture.
Oh, the hula is everything to Hawaiian culture. Why? Because, first of all, because of the olelo, right, of the Hawaiian language that was first shunned and said, no, you will not speak Hawaiian, because we were subjugated. We were not free. We were not the kingdom that we were before.
There was a long period where hula was not allowed because of U.S. colonialism. How did it come back? How did communities bring it back?
You know, it probably is just because they loved the hula. So people couldn't help but keep teaching, even if it was only in the small outer areas. It became very hidden, right? It became, okay, I can hold this and learn it and share it, but it had to be very subtle until the renaissance of our Hawaiian culture and understanding. And Merry Monarch gave everybody the freedom to find a way of delivering the art and creating new art of hula for the world and for ourselves.
So there's two broad categories. There's the ancient dance, which has strong movements and very percussive. And there's the wandering hula, which is the more lyrical style to the music of guitars and ukuleles. Tell me about each one.
Well, I think the kahiko takes us back to the sense of cultural presence that belongs to an ancient culture. That we were there, that we were alive, that we did share. Many of the ali'i, the royalty, composed songs and mele. And then some of these became the wonderful art of hula that was designed and cared for by the kumu hula, the teacher that had his or her halau, a school of dance together, Hawaiian style. So it taught everybody how to be better people as well as better dancers and caring for the wonderful language of Hawaii and the beautiful mele, the songs of the islands.
There's the famous Queen's Prayer from 1895.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, written by the Hawaiian queen who was overthrown by the U.S. government. Can I put you on the spot, Kimo, and ask you to sing a verse for us?
Oko aloha no. Ai ai kalani. A oko oya ino. He molele hoi no lai lai ka haku malalo koe he ko ma ko maluhia a maulo aku no a mene.
Wow, that is just beautiful. Roughly translate that for us. What were you singing?
So what you heard was definitely the olelo of the Hawaiian language, and it was almost destroyed, but it wasn't, because we have it today, and we have the care of people in their hearts, and we have people who are not afraid to still speak out in the language, the mana, the power, and the spirit of all that is Hawaii.
You know, you're making me wonder, Kimo, if the younger generation knows, would be able to, say, sing a verse of the Queen's Prayer. I know hula has evolved a lot, and dancers sometimes wear jeans and T-shirts and not the traditional dress, like grass skirts and leis. How is hula evolving, and how is the younger generation coming to it?
Oh, I think the younger generation actually are learning more about Olelo Hawaii, and therefore not just the language, but the kauna, the underlying meaning of the message that we share. And so whether it was created in ancient days or during that time of our transition or today, it is vibrant that the young ones who have accepted the olelo and learn it are vibrant in how they want to progress and move forward. So we will see even more, not less, of the heart and spirit of Hawaii at the Merry Monarch Hula Festival.
I want to ask you just about yourself, because you have had such a storied and varied career. You acted on shows like Hawaii Five-O, and you're also a Polynesian fire knife dancer. Tell me about that.
Well, I wanted to do the strongest dance in all of the Pacific. And when you handle fire, it's pretty strong because, you know, you can't get burned.
Mm-hmm.
And showbiz-wise, it was fantastic. You own the audience. You have to do it respectfully to the Samoan culture, who are our cousins. Mm-hmm. And their dance started off with blades, sharp knives, and you can get cut that way.
And did you get cut as you learned how to do it, or get burned?
I got a little cut, a little burn, but nothing that took me away from it. The only thing that took me away from the dance was the reality of hurting my lungs. So after dancing for maybe 15 years, I had to look at, okay, what other things are approachable? There's the fire knife dancer, there's the instrument that belongs to the musician, there's the hula garb, all of the hula skirts and dances and things that the costumes that the dancers have to wear. So what is, the MC.
Mm-hmm.
He walks around using the microphone and brings the audience to the show with a very special feeling. He's the one who carries that wonderful momentum. He's the one who cheers them on to
Absolutely.
Understand Hawaii and to enjoy it.
Well, you know, I want to go out on this note, because you are also famous for a classic 1982 song, Aloha Friday. Let's listen for a sec.
It's Aloha Friday, no work till Monday.
Kimo Kahuano is the longtime host of the Merry Monarch Hula Festival on TV. Thank you so much for joining us, Kimo.
Oh, mahalo. Thank you.
No work till Monday.
And mahalo to you for listening. This show comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Koyani Saxena and Lynn Menegon. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Peter O'Dowd, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Theme music by Mike, Max, and me. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.